Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. So, welcome. You are listening to the Global Product Management Talk. This is Cindy Faye Solomon, delighted to be your host today. We are broadcasting live from Tech Liminal in downtown Oakland, right in the Ask Building. This is a tech salon and hot spot where Startup Product Academy has been operating out of and offering product therapy and the Startup Product Talks East Bay Meetup has been meeting here. I am delighted to have our guest today is Vaughn Schoner, who is an author and PhD, and he will be talking about his book, The Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, How to Bootstrap Your Startup, Lead Through Tough Times, and Cash In for Success. But before we bring him on, I want to tell you a little bit about the Global Product Management Talk. You can find us on Blog Talk Radio at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTPALK. That is our Twitter handle and our hashtag. It is PRODMGMTPALK. You can find archives of over 100 episodes, as well as our syndicated shows, Product Superheroes, and Competitive Intelligence and Insights. And we are also available on iTunes, on Stitcher, as well as the Android mobile app, the Pod Management Talk, available in the Google Play Store. Again, just search for PRODMGMTPALK, and you will find us. And welcome to our live listeners today. I want to thank our sponsors who bring you the Global Product Management Talk. The AIPMM is the Association of International Product Marketing and Management. You can find them on the web at AIPMM.com. Follow them on Twitter at AIPMM, where they post great events coming up. They are the worldwide certifying body for certified product managers, certified product marketing managers, certified brand managers, certified agile product managers, and they offer the only worldwide credentials and certifications. They also have an excellent webinar series on Friday, so check them out. Also, thank you to Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. You can listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want, and you can get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/PRODMGMTPALK. audibletrial.com/PRODMGMTPALK. The Startup Product Movement is the movement for product excellence. Go to startupproduct.com. You will find out about upcoming broadcasts as well as Product Week San Francisco coming up in November, which is 4 days of events for product professionals, entrepreneurs, startup founders, developers, designers, and as well as product professionals in all size organizations. Startup Product Summit will start off the week. It is focused on the future of product, productivity, and product management. That will be followed by an all-day workshop day where you can take 4 workshops to go deep into issues having to do with design, development, scaling, growth hacking. On Saturday will be a no-code hackathon from ProtoHacks, where you'll work with a team to actually put together your product and present it in the evening. And Sunday will be Product Camp San Francisco, an unconference for everyone to come together to present their expertise or to talk about areas and put together a group to talk about things that you want to go deep into in the morning that's based on unconference, base camp. Everyone will decide on the agenda. Also, check out Webcast Digest, daily curated educational free online events for your continuous learning at Webcast Digest and webcastdigest.com. If you have a free hour, you can check out the calendar and attend a live online or virtual event to get to expand your learning, your education, and your exposure to different verticals and vendors. You can search on 8 different categories, from technical, agile, to marketing, to IT, services, and all kinds of issues. Okay, and again, thank you to TechLiminal. Tonight at TechLiminal in Oakland is 2.0 Oakland Demo Evening, where there will be local startups showcasing their works in progress, and there will be judges and a great community right here in downtown Oakland. So today, I am delighted to have on the show Bon Schoner. He's a PhD and author of the Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide. And most technology startups never make it to the funding state, and only a small percentage of those that are venture-backed generate positive returns for their investors. However, an even smaller number of startup founders enjoy a prosperous exit. According to our guest, assembling your founding team is a make-or-break move that every business faces. In fact, he says that it determines the path and outcome of a new venture more than any decision in the life cycle of a company. So our guest, Bon Schoner, comes from a small town in Germany, and he was a research assistant at the MIT Media Lab. He worked in the Physics of Media Group and the Things That Think Research Consortium. He is a success story in tech entrepreneurship. He is the co-founder of ThingMagic, which is a garage-grown RFID technology company. And he holds a degree in electrical engineering. He was valedictorian of his class. He has a degree in industrial engineering, and he received his PhD from the MIT Media Lab. And by the way, this is a Global Product Management Talk. We're a top 10 business podcast on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I'm your host, Cindy Faye Solomon. You can follow me at Cindy F. Solomon. And thank you also to our friends at CrowdChat. Go over to crowdchat.net/prodmgmttalk and join us in the discussion. Bound. Are you still on with us? That is the extent of the introduction. What did I leave out?
I think you covered it pretty well. Thanks a lot for having me, and thanks for the kind introduction. Yes, all the major events in my life you covered in your introduction.
Great. Well, I must say that your press materials are amongst the most extensive and thorough materials that I've seen of all the authors we've had on. So great job to your team.
Yeah, my PR firm deserves a lot of credit. They have done a great job. Thank you.
Yeah. And I also did include one of your videos. So you have a lot of interviews out on YouTube, which I really enjoyed, and that was included in the press release we flighted as well. So our audience, this really started as a vehicle to raise the visibility of what product managers do across industry, across different types of product. And we really started as a Twitter chat, and we've grown not only into this broadcast, but into a worldwide community of people who are passionate about product. Why don't you give us a little background on how you took ThingMagic and grew it in what your involvement is currently?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to give you a little bit of background. And I should probably say up front that in many ways, especially how we operated early on and sort of the chaotic early days of our startup, it's probably exactly how you shouldn't be doing product marketing and product development. And part of it is you know, as a startup, you oftentimes stumble into what you're doing, right? It's not always that thought out process. In fact, you know, oftentimes you don't have the resources and the time to do what large companies do, which is, you know, sort of methodically research the market, research what people need, and then do it. For startups, it's all oftentimes, you know, there isn't such methods, so everything is sort of compensated with enthusiasm and get, you know, let's just do it mentality. And I think that was certainly true in our case. We started off in 2000 at a time when essentially the entrepreneurship scene was completely disintegrating because of the dot-com bubble hitting everybody really, really hard. So, you know, we had almost no money to that we could raise, and we ultimately decided that we wouldn't raise money. We would bootstrap the company. We came to the company with sort of the idealist idea that we could keep developing what's interesting and what we like. We all had a scientific and engineering research background, and we really wanted to keep doing interesting things, not just things that would make money. At the same time, we also wanted to be participating in a potential upside, which is usually what you get out of a private enterprise, not out of academia. So when we started with these constraints, we basically said, let's do technology and device development for others as a service, because that way we could generate cash immediately, fund ourselves as a company without third-party investments. But at the same time, we would be continuing to work on the kinds of technologies that we were good at and that we liked. And it was really through that model worked reasonably well early on, that we slowly found our place in a vertical market, which is radio frequency identification, RFID, because it still happened that at the time in the early 2000s, there was a lot of activity in that space, and we sort of stumbled into that by virtue of what we knew how to do, where our skills were, and the fact that that was a particular technology where people were looking for help. It was very new at the time, so there wasn't a lot of expertise around the world, but we happened to have a lot of touch points with RFID technology at MIT, so we were sort of the natural go-to people to help others develop product in that space. And out of that really grew then our specialty, which is RFID tag readers. And then yet another few years later, we decided that it now was time to take venture capital and do product development for real. And at that point, we turned ourselves into an RFID product company. So we started, you know, dedicated designs, and we started manufacturing, and we ultimately became the company that we're still today, which is specializing in the design and manufacturing of high-performance RFID readers. And now we are actually much more proficient when it comes to product development and product marketing.
So the pursuit of I guess we'd call it product market fit, led you to then put in process.
At some point you realize that when you're looking at a multi-million-dollar development process, and you're not just stumbling into it, you're saying, okay, we're going to spend the next 12 months developing this particular product. We better make sure that what we're developing is actually going to be successful, right? So at that point, you say, well, we have to have a product manager who basically guides everybody through that process. We don't want to build things anymore because we can. We want to build them because they'll make money and they'll be attractive to the target market. So, yeah, we started to hire product managers, and it took us some time to sort of develop a feel for that process. Yeah, it's not something you can just turn on, especially if you're sort of coming from a history of let's just do it, or this looks interesting, let's do it, right? You really have to sort of come up with this overlay of discipline to say, that's one important ingredient, right? It should be interesting. It should be something that not everybody can do, right? You want to have a competitive advantage. But you also need the discipline of sitting down and talking to customers and upfront and to see whether they will buy it if you make it. And then, that's typically done by product managers. I think to this day, I can say that finding a good product manager who sort of has the right mix of technical ability and sort of technical imagination paired with the ability to talk to the customers and have sort of that sales person attitude, that's a very hard thing to find. And we certainly had a few people that didn't work out that way over the last 14 years that we have been in business. When you do find someone who's doing a good job, keep them. They're very valuable.
So I'm typing here, so I'm trying to mute myself.
Okay, I once in a while there's a little moment of silence, but as long as that's okay with you, then... I get a little nervous.
Fine.
But
No, you're doing great. So at what point, at how many people or how far into the process did it become apparent that you needed that individual, we call it the unicorn, the person who is technically adept, but also has the other soft skills necessary as well as visionary to guide the product and to see what the opportunity is and to test it with the customers. How big was the development team when you realized that you could afford or it was necessary to have that person who wasn't also developing?
I think if I'm looking back, I think we were about 25 people when we hired the first product manager. I think that was rather late, arguably too late. But every story is a little different, and it's usually these kind of personnel decisions and whom to hire and why. That's especially in a startup. There's a lot of, early on. There's a lot of opportunistic moves. Someone knows somebody, and therefore that person joins, but he's not a real product manager. He's really an engineering manager. So, there he goes, but you have an engineering manager first. So I think, arguably you should have a product manager in place. I think when your engineering group is between 5 and 10 people, I think that's when you should start thinking about having someone look at the engineering objectives with sort of a broader agenda, not just delivering it. So I think in our case we were late to that game. That it can work out well if you sort of have your natural place and you're sort of going with the flow. Right? I don't think it's always necessary to have everything completely planned out. I think having a little bit of chaos early on is a good thing because, as we all know, even with excellent product marketing, that's no guarantee that what you're doing is going to work or be successful. You can make it more probable that your product will be a market success. But there's this last bit of randomness and uncertainty and non-predictability that I think comes with every product marketing decision and product decision. Startups have the advantage that they bring a lot of other things to the table that are not really traditional product management that can help them be successful. So you don't really want to kill that too early, right? You don't want to kill that enthusiasm. You don't want to kill that the brilliance that comes sometimes with people who come right out of grad school and they're full of ideas. They also have seen sort of the latest of greatest in a particular field, right? You don't want to kill that with a stiff product marketing manager who says, and how many dollars is that going to make me, right? So it's a little bit of a striking a balance between order and methodology, but also enabling and leveraging that the specific skill and the specifics of a startup environment to create something new, right, that hasn't been there, which is sort of another reason why finding a right product manager for a startup can be challenging, because it's easy to sort of end up too much in a sort of bureaucratic camp where the guy has to make sure there's no uncertainty left whatsoever, and usually it doesn't work that way, right? You end up killing your product before you even started it.
So these are the challenges, and of course, the team has to be able to be responsive and switch, and it's also challenging to work with people who are providing support. I'm finding in web-based products, we need design immediately. But yet, as we keep shifting the focus of the product, it's going to affect the design, which can be really frustrating. So what would you caution first-time entrepreneurs in terms of the biggest mistakes that you see them making? And I think we would agree that waiting too long to bring on a product manager, but it's very difficult to know when the exact time is. And to your point, I do, my observation, it's anywhere between 10 and, starting at 10 developers, depending on if the team already has an understanding of the value of product manager, of what product management can do, it'll be between 10 and 25 when they bring in the first. And you're right, and often they go through many product managers because that product manager may have been successful in one environment, even in the same, domain, doesn't mean that they can be successful, coming in with a new team that's already been in process.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think with product managers in particular, the role is not very well defined a priori, which means you find a lot of different types of program managers, different styles, different strengths. And depending on their strengths, right, you can leverage that, but what I have found very hard is to try to turn them into a different person, right? If you really need someone who is going out, talk to customers, travel, and basically learn about the space, don't think that the technically focused guy who is really half an engineer can do that or will do that, right? He'll be sitting on his desk or bench, and he'll try to figure out what the technical best solution is, right? And likewise, if you need that, right, if you need someone who's really working really closely with the engineers, because the engineers are somewhat going wild, then don't get that marketing and sales-oriented person who doesn't have enough insights into technology to be a real good mentor for the engineering team. So one of the mistakes that we have made is exactly that. We said, we need a product manager, and we look at a bunch of candidates. We hire the person who we think is the best. And then it turns out that that person was actually maybe a good program manager, product manager, but not for the specific task that we needed fulfilled or the specific domain that we were in, right? In our space, we have the additional complication that we do certainly a lot of hardware. We do RF, which is a very different beast than, say, host software or cloud software or anything like that, right? And yet we we do have a lot of embedded software in, that's part of what we do. So you, in a way, the product itself, you know, spans such a large, you know, so many areas and domains, right? And yet, as a small company, you can't just say, oh, we're going to have a product manager for software, we have one for RF, and we have one for digital hardware, right? You don't have that many slots to fill, and you certainly can't pay for it. So you end up with a person that may be doing one of those areas well, but not the others, right? And then you're trying to sort of teach him or force him into something that he's not. I've found that to be very counterproductive. So I think it's important that the entrepreneur, the founder, or the management team, the CEO, defines the role very well, right? And they can't ask a person to be everything, right? They have to say, look, I want you to figure out which of the following five market segments is the biggest, and we should go after that, right? That's a fairly, you know, well-defined task. Or, you know, we have decided that we're going to go with this particular vertical, so we know we're going to do asset management in heavy industrial environments, right? Please figure out what the best product is, you know, or, you know, usually you narrow it down, well, you are already in a particular space and you know, we want to have design a solution for that particular vertical. Figure out what the feature set is, right? And with a very specific task and scope of work, I think you can find a good person to do that. What's hard is if you basically say, to a, you know, ultimately a middle manager, product manager, you know, run product management for us. Yeah, that doesn't typically work. And in a startup that, you know, that the situation is just so usually different from an established company because, you have a small team, you have typically a few executives, and that team really, yeah, has to carry the weight. So product management, and then, you know, the other important aspect of that is product management in a startup means it's sort of make or fail, right? it's not something where you can say, oh, we ran so successful with this one, but the other one is going to carry it forward, right? In a startup, you typically have one product. So it better be successful, otherwise the company dies. Which means that a lot of the product management responsibility sort of goes back to the senior leadership of the team, right? You can't just delegate it. You have to be heavily involved in the product management process as the founder or as the senior management team. And the product manager, when you bring him on board, becomes more of a, yeah, someone who is executing on certain aspects of that, right? So, for example, you tell them, we decided, or for the following reasons, we decided to go into this vertical. Now, you know, basically, take it from here and make a suggestion for the best product. Or any other aspect of the product development process. But you wouldn't say, you know, we are a startup, and I want you to figure out which product we are going to do, right? That's too ill-defined a task for a product manager.
Excellent. So I just want to give a shout out to some of our participants. A great friend of the show, shout out to Alicia Dixon, who retweeted that the role of product management is not well-defined a priori. There's lots of different styles and strengths, as well as to Umesh Maji, who also resonated with that tweet. So thanks for listening, guys. And you're listening, by the way, to the Global Product Management Talk. Our guest today is Vaughn Schoner. He is PhD and author of the Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, How to Bootstrap Your Startup, Lead Through Tough Times, and Cash In for Success. And speaking of your book, do you go into these issues that I'm having you zero in on the product management issues, but do you address that specifically in the book?
Can you say that question one more time? I did not get the question.
I'm having you zero in on discussing product management early on in a startup. Do you address that specifically in the book?
Actually, yeah, the book is a little more general than that. So I don't spend much time in the book on, for example, which markets to go into or what kind of idea to pursue. The book is certainly, yeah, given my own experience, you know, very much centered around a high-tech entrepreneur and tipping, you know, in the sort of hardware software kind of sense. So I'm not the internet kind of entrepreneur. I'm sort of a nuts and bolts guy that way. So I talk a lot about what it takes to bring a hardware company off the ground. But I don't necessarily talk about product management per se. I do talk about selecting the team and so that, you know, that's a pretty important task, as I think you mentioned that in the introduction also. Product management is not sort of on the list of the five or six initial key people, but I think it comes back to that notion that really the team is the product manager initially, right? It's not something that happens in the background by someone that you delegate to. It's really the entire team is involved in that process, and everybody has to talk to everybody to come up with the best strategy forward.
Exactly. And that, I would say, is a theme that has grown the startup product movement into this, it's now this 20 communities worldwide, and it really has to do with, yes, product management in and of itself is a profession, but everyone on the team should be well-versed, and the more knowledge they have about process and different things that a product manager would focus on, the first five people, if they have exposure to those kinds of activities and deliverables and processes, it's going to increase their speed to get to success. And I find that a lot of times just engineers or the developer teams, they have no exposure to what product management is. And certainly Steve Blank and the Lean movement and everything that they're talking about in terms of best practices really come out of traditional product management.
Yeah. There's another sort of interesting tension there in terms of, you know, and I know that we went through a number of iterations of the question of where is product management actually reporting to, right? We started off by having product management report to the VP of marketing, which turned out to be a disastrous because there was an utter disconnect between, you know, what product management would cook up or would come up with, and the technical feasibility and sort of a lack of inspiration from the technical side, right? Later on, we stuck it with engineering, so the product manager would report in the VP of engineering, which was also difficult because now you sort of lacked that commercial side of the equation, right? So the product manager was very technical, you know, he connected well with the engineers, but he didn't have the exposure to the sales and commercial side of things. So that's a, you know, very tricky thing to work out. And you know, in a small company, oftentimes there's no, you know, everybody talks to everybody anyhow. But when you reach sort of the, you know, the 50, 60 people kind of stage, which we were at the time, then that's also a tricky thing to make happen. And obviously, you know, it all depends on the individuals, both the people, actually the actual product managers, but also, you know, the people they report to, right? You can have a very technical VP of marketing, and you can have a very commercially minded VP of engineering, but if you don't, then you get these kinds of gaps in terms of the coverage of the product management function, and that's difficult to overcome. We also always stumbled over the difference and the overlap between product marketing and program, or product marketing and management, and then program management, which is sort of another interesting tension. In many places, you know, program managers or product marketing people, since they are responsible for delivering the product, then also take on program management responsibility. So they, in other words, they are, you know, kicking the engineers in the behind to get it done, which is, you know, sometimes it's good. It's a good thing because the person who is supposed to deliver and who is ultimately responsible for the success of the program is the product marketing manager. So they are certainly motivated to make it make it happen and on time and with all the features that they want. At the same time, you know, it becomes more of an execution rather than you know, for the product marketing manager to think about, you know, what really should be done. He, you know, becomes all concerned about what is being done today and how do we get this product to market versus thinking about what's next.
Exactly. you're definitely describing the dilemma, and I see it all the time. And, you know, I coach people who are in product management or want to get into product management, and oftentimes they think, you know, early on in their career, they think, oh, they're doing something wrong because the organization doesn't know where to place them, or it's something that they're lacking because there is this difficulty and unclarity, and I try to, you know, reframe it for them. This is the nature of the beast. This is the opportunity, the challenge, and even as a product manager, you must be almost become an educator within the organization to constantly be sharing your insights, bringing people together, working cross-functionally, and also raising the visibility of the value of product management. But if you get moved around or downsized or whatever, that's part of being a warrior. it comes with the title.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's this inherent tension, and it's a good one if it's handled right, because out of that tension, you know, hopefully you can grow the best possible product for the company. But it's certainly not something that happens naturally. It's something that, you know, the company has to fight for, and also the senior management has to sort of provide the framework and the environment that good product management can happen, and that, you know, create the respect for that person on the engineering team and on the sales team, because, you know, oftentimes the product manager is the guy who gets caught in the middle. You know, the sales team wants something, the product manager has to say, no, you can have that because 9 other people want this other thing. So that's that other thing that we're going to do, right? And likewise, relative to the engineering team, you know, what they think is the right thing to do may be completely at odds with what the market wants, right? So you have a lot of conflicting demands on the product manager in many cases. And you should find a person who can handle that, who can handle that well. And if you do, then you have a recipe for success. If you don't, you know, it will hurt.
So what advice do you have for a recent college graduate? And so many of them, you know, they get their CS degrees. Or then they realize that they want to get into management, they go get their MBAs, but then they can't get into product management without experience. So they're told, well, start your own product or take a domain. You know, I tell people, look at a product or a organization that you like and start blogging about it or critiquing it or offering suggestions to show your understanding of what they're trying to do. What advice would you give a recent college graduate before they venture into a startup?
So I think that the one interesting thing is, you know, there's a lot of paths that a company founder can actually take, but I think that going into product management and sort of guiding that that process is a very natural path for a founder to take. You know, they, especially if it's a technical, someone with a technical background, then he sort of by definition has that strength, the technical strength, but he also has the commercial dimension, because he is in charge of, you know, making money for the company. If he don't, you know, his company goes away. So I think that's certainly one avenue that makes a lot of sense, right? Join a team early as a co-founder, because that way you have sort of a natural path into doing product management. And yeah, in general, as I point out in the book, you know, being part of the founding team is, I think, yeah, gratifying in itself, and it certainly gives you the degrees of freedom to pick the professional specialty that you want, irrespective of what the company is doing. Now, yeah, you shouldn't, if you have a business degree and you want to be CTO, you know, that can be an issue. But I think there's almost, going into product management, there should be a path for the founder. If you join a company, you know, without being a co-founder, small or large, I do think I would recommend starting from a technical role, because there's nothing worse than a product manager who can't handle the engineering side, right? Who basically becomes a victim of the engineering team, basically telling them stories. you want to have someone who can form an opinion herself or himself regarding the technical merit or a technical approach to a particular problem. I would recommend, you know, that starting on the technical side. If you can't be a product manager right away, you know, do some engineering job or maybe even a QA job that gets you in touch with the technology and gives you a good sense what's working, what's not working, and then proceed to product proceed to product management from there.
I agree. And with such a vast arena of where you could focus from a technical point of view, and there's certainly a huge focus on everyone should learn to code. And I often forget that I learned to code very, very early. And so that was always my ticket in. And then I forget because I do a lot of HTML, but that's not really coding. But I am deeply, I like to be hands-on and close and understanding the technical people, because they're making the product. And if you can't speak to them and understand their pain, then you really, you're missing a key aspect of being able to communicate across the board. So early on, so shifting a little bit because the time is running away, I wanted to ask you, early on in Thing Magic, your team established the principle that every founder and key executive receives the same salary compensation. Why? How long was this in place? And how did that work out? It seems like quite idealistic.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is we were a team of equals, right? We all had, you know, very, very similar education, similar age bracket too. We had similar needs because none of us had families at the time. So in some ways, you know, we were lucky that we could establish it without running into too many problems. And then we also had the issue that as a bootstrap company, we really couldn't pay much more, right? So what I found was that this equal compensation, at least on the cash side, on the salary side, meant that Yeah, everybody is working towards a common goal, which is to make the equity worth a lot. So there's a sense that we're not here because of the paycheck at the end of the month, right? We all get the same. We can live, we can eat, we can even go on vacation, but that's not what's going to make us rich, so that's not really why we're here, right? That's not the passion. The passion is to build an institution, build a company, and if we are successful and eventually we sell it, then that's basically the big payday. And we manage to maintain that principle. When we hired executives, you know, they certainly didn't get the same as in terms of shares as the founders, but in terms of salary, they largely got the same. Right? We hired a CEO, and he took part in that same scheme as well. We really, I think we maintain it pretty much until we got sold 10 years later. Another interesting aspect about that method is that it's very hard for anyone to complain if everybody gets the same, right? If you establish that principle, who would say, I want more money if the CEO makes the same, right? It both gives a purpose to the team, and it creates a sense of equal suffering and equal amount of passion for a common goal. So I would do it the same way any day.
Yeah, I don't see that too much in Silicon Valley, but again, perhaps it's at the beginning.
I totally agree with you. I don't think it's the sort of standard approach, and certainly not for venture-backed companies in Silicon Valley. But at the moment you take in venture capital, there's a whole lot of constraints that we didn't have because we were bootstrapping. We had other constraints, but we could decide that we would, compensate on that principle. A lot of companies cannot, right? If you basically take in a bunch of money and then you're telling the VC, and now we're going to paying it out on this, through the scheme, the VC said, no, you don't, you won't. I want a salary structure and a cap table that is consistent with industry standards, and what you're doing is not. So, not everybody has the degree of freedom to do it the way we did.
Right. But I applaud that. I mean, it does seem ideal to be equitable. And also in an ideal world, again, people wouldn't need the compensation. I do see so many bootstrappers that, are investing themselves, and it's really a question of how long can you afford to keep doing that without getting a salary? And really, people do need to live, especially if they have families. So also switching over, because there's so much great information here, what can you tell us that a tech entrepreneur should know about patents, and where can they turn for information? I'll tell you that I've been advising a startup, and I recognize that one of the features that they didn't realize, what I thought was a killer feature, and they should abandon all the other features and just focus on this, and I thought they should definitely try and patent the functionality of this particular feature, because nobody else, I hadn't seen that existing elsewhere. But in order to go down the patent route, there's a lot of, you have to have the right lawyers, and there's, you have to do more than a patent search, and then how do you defend the patent? So it took the team off course to pursue that.
Yeah, so the, you know, the patenting and the IP strategy, that's certainly a very important and interesting topic. I mean, one of the things to realize is that the time scale, you know, that comes with patenting and with you know, writing a patent, seeing it issue and enforcing it, you know, that can easily take 10 years, right? So the first thing you have to realize is that startups are typically on a faster pace than the patenting process. So my sort of very high level advice is, you know, both on the offensive patenting yourself and defending yourself against others and their patents, take it seriously, take the matter seriously, think about it, you know, do all the things that you should be doing to figure out the best strategy, but don't let it deter you, right? A single patent will not help you or will not be enough to build your business, right? A single patent is usually also not enough to stop you from doing something, you know, interesting or great. There's usually works around it. There's, you know, most of the patents out there are actually not valid. So a lot of the stuff that people get through the patent office ultimately will not hold up in court, right? And the patent system is designed that the proof is in comes only when someone challenges a patent in court, whether that patent is actually going to uphold, right? And that too, that can take years before you get to that point, right? So if you can avoid it, you should avoid getting infringing on any kind of patent or getting yourself into that kind of trouble, because when it does happen, you know, when you do end up in court, it's usually very costly and time consuming. But don't let it stop you. Right? There's often, you know, founder teams that say, "Oh, we wanted to do this, but then we found this patent. Someone else already patented it." If you can find that one patent, there's probably 10 others that also claim the same thing, which also means that at least 9 of them are not valid. Just do due diligence. If you have something interesting, you know, file a patent, and there's lots of ways also to keep the budget for patenting reasonable, you know, and I actually in the book I describe some of those strategies to, even with a small budget, cover lots of grounds in terms of protecting your IP. You know, one is what's called a kitchen sink patent, right? So, which basically means that you write a very, very, very long document where you describe everything you are trying to do or you are doing as a company. And then over the years, you file claims against that invention, and you can actually turn that one patent into many, many different patents. And by doing that, you save a ton of money. So actually, this might be a good time to tell the listeners where they can get the book. You can go to my website, which is berndus. Again, that's berndus, and you can go from there to Amazon or other places to buy the book, or you can directly go to Amazon and type in my full name. In one chapter I cover the patenting topic in quite some detail with very explicit strategies for how to push the system, especially as a small company, and get a lot of bang for little bucks in terms of patenting your inventions.
Excellent. I was tweeting out, so the name of the book is The Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, How to Bootstrap Your Startup, Lead Through Tough Times, and Cash In for Success. And there's some great information in there on the having a patent strategy and some tips. That's great. I haven't heard, no patent lawyer has described to me the kitchen patent. So.
Yeah, they don't necessarily like it. It's not pretty, but then, you know, that's not the point. You know, you want your product to be pretty, but the patent doesn't have to be pretty.
And so we're coming to the end of the hour, but I really appreciate that you do focus on the family life of entrepreneurs. So do you have any advice that you'd like to leave us with for entrepreneurs and their families?
So we talk a lot about the risk in entrepreneurship and how risky it is to start your own company. In the book, I make the point that it's not really risky. It's just there's a lot of uncertainty around it, right? As a tech entrepreneur, you actually enjoy a lot more protection than many people think, right? If you're working for a large company, the chances that you get laid off at least once in your lifetime are actually very high, right? If you're running your own company, the worst case is that you lose your job like everybody else, but you'll probably have an easier time finding another one. So I don't agree with the notion that entrepreneurship is risky. I do agree that it's very uncertain. In other words, when you get started, you don't know where it's going to take you. There's a good chance you'll be successful, but you don't know how successful, and you don't know how long it will take. Yeah, it may take you 3 startups before you finally have a home run. But that uncertainty is really what you have to deal with. And I can tell you that I myself, that was really the hardest thing about finding my own company, yet dealing with this notion that I don't know what tomorrow will bring, what next year will bring, how long it's going to take to finally exit the company, sell it. And there were many times when I said, oh, maybe this is not going anywhere. I should do something else, right? In fact, 3 out of my 5 co-founders decided to leave the company before they we exited it. So that uncertainty, the entrepreneur certainly has to deal with, and by extension, the entrepreneur's family has to deal with that, right? So the first thing I would think about if you're considering to become an entrepreneur, can you deal with that? Imagine that scenario that you don't really know what's going to happen next year. So make sure you can deal with uncertainty is the number one advice. The number two advice is think very hard about what sort of your minimum requirements are for daily life, right? What do you and your family need and you can't live without, right? And it doesn't matter what it is, whether it's a big car, a big house, or much less than that, right? And then, once again, that extends to your family, right? It's not just you, it's your family. And when you can't meet those basic requirements, then I think it's time to move on and find another job and drop the startup thing, because time passes very quickly, and we read a lot about startups that within a year or two founders are billionaires. That's not what usually happens. But usually it's a tedious process in the beginning. When you get off the ground, it's tedious when you try to grow it. And it can be tedious to finally come to an exit. Certainly, it was certainly the case in for Think Magic, and you don't want to look back and say, oh, I spent 10 years of my life on this thing. It didn't really go anywhere, or we weren't really making a lot of money, and I worked like a dog. My family suffered. You don't want to have to look back and say, I really sacrificed that decade and that time is not going to come back. You want to be able to look back and say, it was hard work, but it was a lot of fun, and I don't want to miss that period of my life.
Absolutely. And you want to, whether the startup takes off or not, you want to come away from it with a learning, a very great learning experience that you can apply to your next startup or contribute to your next team, but definitely move forward from it. And I really appreciate you pointing to the realities of, hey, it's hard work, and it's hard work for a long time. And we only hear about the glorious, successful ones, which is a very small percentage. And we're also not hearing, we're only hearing about it in media. We're not really knowing what actually happened. So if you're in a startup and your experience does not is not glorious, you're probably doing it right. That is the reality. just hold the course. And definitely read Baum's book on the harsh realities of a tech startup and learn from the people who have gone before. Pick up the Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, How to Bootstrap Your Startup, Lead Through Tough Times and Cash In for Success. Follow us on the Global Product Management Talk at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you so much for joining us today, Baum. This was very insightful. And certainly did cover a lot of ground, and I appreciate your focusing on product management because for me that shows up in every discussion. It's a key endeavor. So thank you.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.
And I look forward to talking with you further. And I want to thank the listeners and the tweeters. And check out the blog post at Startup Product. And this is Cindy Faye Solomon. Thank you to Tech Liminal for hosting the live broadcast today. Join us if you're in town for the 2.0 Oakland demo event tonight. And find a startup product meetup in your neighborhood or start one. Thanks again, Baum Schoner. Pick up the book, Tech Entrepreneur Survival Guide, and have a great week.